Welcome, everybody, to the January 16th board meeting. We have a quorum. We have four of the five directors here with Iggy Fedorov away. Please stand and join me in the pledge.
Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have come out of closed session with the decision to accept the contract we have before us. If the feedback from the public is positive, is there any public comment? Well, there being no public comment, we then are appointing Maureen Robles as our administrator. I don't know if the staff present knows much about Maureen. I have somewhere. I had somewhere a summary of Maureen's experience. But I have lost it. Oh, here it is right in front of me. I shall take the liberty of reading you part of it. Maureen is a resident of Cambria. She brings a wide range of experience to the role. She's a retired colonel from the U.S. Army, a combat veteran from Desert Shield and Desert Storm, and was officer in charge of the emergency and outpatient services at Dubai Hospital in the United Arab Emirates, which treated U.S. military personnel. She also served as commander in Los Alamitos and served as the acting commander of the 349th Combat Support Hospital, responsible for deploying, mobilizing, the reintegration of the returning 300 troops from overseas. She is a recipient of the Legion of Merit Award. She earned her master's degree in nursing, focusing on pulmonary nursing and administration from the UCLA School of Nursing. And she also graduated from UCLA's John Anderson School of Business Executive Management Program. She served as director administrator for the UCLA Home Health Agency in Los Angeles, where she was responsible for financial, billing, and clinical operations, and she was senior vice president for the Visiting Nurse Association of Los Angeles, a very large operation. Maureen will have 24/7 responsibility for the district and will work 20 hours a week beginning tomorrow, Thursday the 16th. Needless to say, we're very pleased to have Maureen on board. Please join us in welcoming her to this important role. One thing that I did not do that I should have done is state what the compensation would be in her contract, which is public. Her benefits were clearly stated, but we left blank for our closed session discussion the actual salary. And Maureen will be making $78,000 a year for her service. She will be receiving no health benefits, but she will be receiving sick day and vacation time. And it's all delineated in the contract in your packet. Maureen, would you like to say a few words?
Gosh, there's not really very many people here to say. I'm going to say, number one, I want to thank the board for putting their trust in me. And as a resident, I'm excited to be part of continuing a legacy in this community. You know, we're really fortunate to have... I think we're really fortunate here in Cambria
to have a legacy of an ambulance service. When I was in nursing school, there was no such thing as ambulance services for emergencies. And that was a long time ago. And what actually started that whole movement was we had a police officer in L.A. who was shot. And there was the only thing they could do was take him to the receiving hospital, which was quite a ways away. And that started a national movement of they passed many other hospitals in Round. So anyway, I actually consider us very fortunate here. I can't imagine this community without having services. Knowing that we have access to emergency care is for ourselves and our loved ones, our neighbors. And that legacy's been around about 70 years, right? I think it would be very sad if we couldn't continue that here. Unfortunately, healthcare is getting tougher and tougher to keep excellent care and costs aligned. So it's going to take all of us to make this happen. But it's our legacy. It's up to us. And I think that's why I'm really excited to work with this board, the staff, our partners, and really work to find a way to keep this this health district, you know, financially solid and still able to do what it's done for the last 70 years. But that's basically why I'm here. So thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you. I now get to introduce Douglas Brim, and I have a bio for him, too. Douglas received a bachelor's degree in biological sciences from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He is a state-licensed and locally accredited paramedic who has worked on first responder 911 ambulances for the past 15 years. He's taught many emergency responders in classes for the National Association of EMTs, the American Heart Association, EMT programs, tactical EMS courses, and he was a lead instructor at Cuesta Community College's Central Coast Paramedic Program for 8 years. Douglas currently works for the County of San Luis Obispo Emergency Medical Services Agency as an EMS coordinator, where he performs system-wide QI and coordinates the community EMS systems trauma and provider education programs. He also creates excellent presentations to provide to us to tell us what our quality and experience has been over the last year. So thank you very much for coming, and welcome.
Thank you. I hope it's excellent. We'll see. Thank you for the introduction. I'm going to stand over here because I'm tethered, if that's all right. Heidi, hand me a microphone. I think I can project and cover those, but by all means, if you guys can't have difficulty hearing me, let me know. I'll try talking to the mic instead.
The benefit of the microphone is for posterity, in that The presentation will be saved on the audio.
Will do. I'm not too good with a microphone, so if I end up forgetting and dropping it down by my side, just give me a reminder. I did want to state, in addition to my bio, off right at the bat, as a matter of transparency and clarity, I do work as a reserve paramedic occasionally for the healthcare district as well, although my primary job, as discussed in my bio, is working for the EMS agency and as a QI coordinator there. And that's the role in which I'm giving this presentation today. So, with that being said, I want to talk a little bit about, before I really get into the data in the presentation, about the data collection process. As the board is well aware, very familiar with, last year, 2018, was a year of transition in the electronic healthcare records that the healthcare district was using to collect its records, transitioning from Simon Nomis platform to an ImageTrend platform. Additionally, in 2017, the year before that, Simon Nomis platform itself, due to new state regulations changing reporting requirements for all ambulance healthcare records, had transitioned within that platform from Simon version 1 to version 2. These were very significant changes in how data is collected, and on the flip side, as a QI analyst, how I can gather the data and reconcile it together. So I just want to put that out there right now, because as we go through the presentation, you'll hear me mention that this data set was only from this source, or from this source, or there might have been some complication in reconciling the sources. Where I could, I reconciled both sources to give a complete picture of 2018, but you'll hear me mention in places where I couldn't do that, and try to use the best representative sample that I could as a way of doing that. That transition, which has happened all across California, all across the county, not just in the healthcare district, has created some difficulties in reconciling this data, as I talked about. But overall, it's a good thing. It's a drive towards improving data collection for EMS systems across the entire state, so that we can do true apples to apples comparisons with our QI analysis across the system and have better data, so that we can make better decisions for healthcare across the state. So it's a step in the right direction, even though it's created some difficulties for us all in transition. So with that being said, I'll go ahead and get started. The first slide I have here is just a annual comparison of total requests for service and transports for the Cambria Community Healthcare District. You can see we've done a comparison here from 2016, 2017, and 2018. Our first bar back there is total responses for requests for 911 service. So this would have excluded any types of requests for service for transfers, although for the data set that I have, there were none for the community healthcare district anyways. Next one, after the total responses, we have how many of those responses were for Code 3 emergency lights and sirens responses, as opposed to urgent but non-urgent, no lights and sirens responses. And then the number that were transported of those total responses, and how many of them were transported emergency lights and sirens. You can see in general, doing a comparison from 2016, 2017 to 2018, that there's been a bit of a drop from the previous years. As you guys are aware, Highway 1 was closed to the north throughout much of 2018, and we speculate that maybe that may have caused some decrease in total call volume. And overall, it's not necessarily a statistically significant drop, even though the raw numbers are obviously different. We'll take a look at that slide next. So this is a slide that's demonstrating with statistical validation the volume of 911 responses both here in the healthcare district, or specifically for Cambria Community Healthcare District ambulances, and the volume of responses for the entire county, inclusive of Cambria Community Healthcare District ambulances. The top figure is the one for healthcare district ambulances, and it's going back longitudinally from 2010 all the way through 2018, inclusive of all responses. This is what's known as a process run control chart. If anybody's not familiar with that, the really general description of it is that it is organize the data around a running average, which is the blue line in the middle, and then establishes a statistical lower limit and upper limit. And again, to state it simply, anything that is around that average line in the middle but doesn't exceed the upper control limit or the lower control limit, statistically speaking, is considered to just be a variation around the mean and not representative of an actual statistical change. And so looking at that from 2010 to 2018, call response volume for the healthcare district ambulances specifically hasn't statistically increased or decreased. It's just had variation around the mean. The countywide numbers, however, which again is inclusive of Cambria Community Healthcare District responses as well as everything else in the county, has had an increase over that same time period from 2010 to 2018. Again, this is somewhat speculation, but we noticed that there appears to have been an upward trend from 2013 through 2016, and then there's been speculation within the county that the from 2016, 2017 to 2018, the county-wide response volume is leveling off. I would argue that statistically we can't say that yet until we get more data in the future to see where it does, what it does next. That time frame from 2014, 2015, 2016 does coincide, and this is again speculation, coincides with implementation of the ACA. So again, it's speculative, but there's certainly been discussion that that may have been an upward trend associated with the change in the changes in healthcare that came along with the ACA, and that there could be a little bit off right now. That's speculation. Just putting it there for your consideration. Next, we have a distribution of calls here in the healthcare district by hour of day for 2018. This is inclusive of all data sets, old data sets from Simon Nomis and new data sets from Image Trend. This is written as a percentage of the total call volume that occurred over 2018. What percent of them began at any given hour of the day? This goes from 0-100 hours or midnight through to 11 p.m. 2300 hours at midnight of the following day, the same day, sorry, I should say. And you can see in general the peak call volume goes from about 7 to 8 a.m. in the morning to dropping off then around 2200 hours or 10 p.m. at night. When we have run this data in the past, we've noticed that drop-off occurring slightly earlier in the evening, between around 8 or 9 with earlier data sets from 2017. Aside from that, the pattern looks pretty much the same. And the pickup of calls starting at 7 or 8 a.m. in the morning has stayed pretty consistent from previous years. And then below that, we have another process run control chart of total call volume for the healthcare district by month for 2018. And again, well, you see some variation depending on the months. I would speculate, or postulate really, that given the statistical measures of the control chart, that it's all just variation around the mean, and that there's not really a significant difference depending on the month in 2018. Moving on, just to get out of charts and get a visual representation a little bit, I have a distribution map of where calls occurred that Cambria Community Healthcare District ambulance has responded to. This is from a narrower data set only from January 2018 through March of 2018, and it's from the data set that was collected in the Simon Nomis electronic health record platform prior to transition of the healthcare district to Image Trend. And this is simply something that can be easily done with the Simon Nomis data. There may be a way to do it yet with Image Trend. Image Trend is a robust program that has lots of tools in it, but I haven't figured out how to make a nice visually appealing map like this in Image Trend yet. So it is a narrow data set, but given that there wasn't a lot of change in call volume totally throughout the entire year, as we saw earlier on the previous slide, I would speculate that this is probably the total distribution somewhat comparable for the entire year of 2018.
Now, excuse me, this yes, is sir. Just for the health district?
Yes, sir. Just for healthcare district analysis.
I'm trying to understand the calls that are the outliers, particularly in South County. Is it the Rio Grande? I'm trying to read from the side here.
Yes, sir. Rio Grande does seem pretty far out of the way. So I didn't review individual calls much because I was dealing with overall numbers. But in general, healthcare district ambulances end up responding to areas outside of their primary response area, Cambria, well, roughly being Via Creek and North, and when at the Summit, as part of mutual aid, when the other ambulances across the county are all busy on calls and depleted to such a level that one of the healthcare district ambulances has to be dispatched to a call outside of their area. And typically, that results in calls in Cayucas, Morbay, Los Osos area, as you can see, with the out-of-area calls. The largest majority of them occur around Cayucas, Morbay, the scattering, of course, elsewhere. Anecdotally, I can tell you from my years of working in EMS in this county, sometimes those have kind of a cascade effect as well, where an ambulance gets called down to, say, Cuesta to cover and just stage waiting for a call. And then as the rest of the county remains really busy, it ends up they get kind of moved further down and rarely you can see it's just one call down the road. And granted, in this data set, that results in them actually getting pulled that far. So
sometimes we see, almost monthly, we see San Luis Obispo calls where we respond really quickly, and obviously we're at the hospital, and there's a need, and we're just right there ready to go.
Yeah, so without reviewing the actual calls, I would speculate that the one all the way down in Arroyo Grande wasn't one of those, because it's unlikely that the ambulance was transporting down that far, but certainly with a number of the ones in San Luis Obispo, and that also occur along Moro Bay, or even over in the Templeton area, they do occur because not because of mutual aid, per se, but after clearing the hospital and dropping off the patient, they just happen to be the closest unit to a call that gets dispatched in that area. As part of the mutual aid plan, it's expected that whoever is the closest unit to a call, even if it's not their primary response area, that they'll still respond and handle that call. So thank you for pointing that out. That's a very good point. This is a representation of the areas across the entire county that Cambria Community Healthcare District ambulances specifically responded to, and a breakdown of the different zones. You see, I didn't include Cambria itself on the bar graph. I just included the raw numbers for that, which was 698 calls in Cambria and 155 canceled calls. I didn't include that on the graph because there was not a good way to scale that. If I included that number on there, then all the others would have been illegible. By and large, of course, what you see here is that the bulk of calls that Healthcare District Ambulances responded to in 2018 did occur in their primary response area, that being, of course, Cambria, San Simeon, Harmony, and then via mutual aid agreement with Monterey County. I would venture to say the lower parts of Monterey County as well, Big Sur and Gorda, which are listed on there. And then, as we just discussed, you see a bit of a spike of calls above everything else in Cayuga, Small Bay, San Luis Obispo, which are the most common places outside of the primary response zone here up in Cambria that Cambria Healthcare Community District ambulances do end up responding to, with a smattering of occasional other ones as far south as Rover Beach and Rover Grande, as you know. Yes, sir.
The cancellation rate in round numbers is about 25%, looking at the Cambria calls. Is that representative across the county?
I did not have a chance to actually crunch the numbers for countywide comparison of canceled calls for this year. In previous years, those rates have been very similar and close to match. Moving on to some information regarding response times. I've got a number of graphs starting off with what we typically refer to as chute time, or time getting out of the chute. And that is the time it takes for a crew from when they're notified by dispatch to actually going en route in the ambulance. And for 2018, and this is inclusive data of both databases, ImageTrend and Simon Nellis databases, the median chute time that crews spent was just barely over 1 minute. In talking about response times with EMS responses, we typically also look at the 90th percentile for how many calls, 90% of calls, what they were under. The 90th percentile for chute time was 2 minutes, and it's not actually 35 seconds, it's 2.35 minutes. And that's pretty consistent with industry standard, depending on where you look across the industry and the county. You have in what's considered usually an acceptable chute time of a 90th percentile set at usually 2 minutes or 3 minutes, depending on where you're looking across the county. That's not something that we at the EMS agency for the county actually prescribe. That's something that agencies sometimes prescribe at a 90th percentile for their chute time. And on this graph, you see that we do have a countywide comparison versus the healthcare district, and by and large, they very closely align for chute times.
Does chute time tend to be longer at night?
You know, that is something that certainly often looked at. I did not look at that in this particular data set. Anecdotally, I would say that typically shoot times do get a little bit longer in the evening. Certainly, again, what is considered an acceptable shoot time is usually defined by an individual agency, not defined by the county, because we just look at total response times, not the shoot times. And I can speak for that. I know a lot of agencies actually set a slightly different shoot time standard between daytime hours and nighttime standard. They say what are common numbers that I've seen at different agencies is 2 minutes is the acceptable shoot time for daytime hours, and 3 minutes is the acceptable shoot time at night. Again, that's agency dependent. That varies a little bit. So this next graph is actual response time, which is what at the county we typically look more at, and this number starts to get a bit more complicated than shoot times. There's various different ways of looking at it and determining what we're really concerned about with it. Here we have on the graph a comparison of healthcare district and comparison to countywide, and distribution of the response times from when the unit went en route to when they were on scene for urgent and emergent calls. So this excludes pre-scheduled transports and non-emergent calls and standbys and things of that nature. And so you can see for all of those calls that the healthcare district responded to, and that's important, it's all of the calls, including the ones down in Oro Grande and Grover Beach. Their response time, the 90th percentile of the response time was 12 minutes. It's also important with these to look at various other statistics. The median response time for that same data set was 4.69 minutes. And that is data that is driving primarily from ImageTrend, because I had a more robust platform for getting that data from ImageTrend than I did in Simon Notes. The other statistics that I'll mention with this are ones that I had to calculate myself, and so you'll notice instead of being 4.69 minutes, we'll talk about actual minutes and seconds on them, so that's the reason for the difference with that. So 12 minutes with the 90th percentile may seem like a long response time, but again,
when you're choking.
What's that?
Only when you're choking.
Especially if you're choking, as an individual drink of water myself right now. But I would remind you guys that is why I'm pointing out it's important. That is for all responses that the healthcare district responded to, including the ones up in Monterey County, rural zones, to zones down in San Luis Obispo, or even further south when they were covering from a mutual aid cover location like Cuesta. And that definitely skews that number longer. From the county level, we look at response times and what we hold people responsible to for meeting response time standards. We usually break those up further into rural zones and non-rural or urban zones, and we allot our times for that. And with rural zones, which would be more inclusive of everything, we usually allot a 90th percentile of, from us at this county, 30 minutes even. The urban zones, therefore, are the ones where we're really looking to keep that that much shorter response window down, and where it's more reasonable to keep that response window down. And so that brings us to those numbers that I included beneath the total response, where we're looking at emergent calls specifically in Cambria, and the 90th percentile for that was 9 minutes and 15 seconds. The median was 5 minutes and 46 seconds. And that's a very reasonable response time. Across the county, the total 90th percentile for response times is, I believe, 10 minutes. So it's even a little bit shorter than that.
So one of the concerns, as you know, I'm sure you know, mm-hmm. is that we cut a night shift ambulance. And
yeah.
Also, coupled with that, we cover, as you know, all the way up to Ragged Point. So we have been looking at the question of if San Luis Ambulance goes to the top of the 46 in the move up and cover experience at night, and if that call is not this side of Cambria but the far side of Cambria or even San Simeon, is that we're wondering how we can ascertain or be certain that that is an adequate response time for people.
Right. And whenever there's mutual aid going on across the county, right, mutual aid, of course, is something that happens going both directions. It's both with San Jose Ambulance covering for your guys area when calls occur here, and as we were talking about earlier, healthcare district ambulances responding and covering for calls outside of this zone when they need it as well. And whenever mutual aid happens due to the fact that the system is depleted in general, response times end up suffering. And that's to be expected, I guess, to some degree. And some degree of that is considered acceptable, as we mentioned earlier, in balancing out the cost of providing quality health care and still maintaining that level of health care. That's a balancing act. Because you brought that up to me, I did run some quick numbers doing something which I think is a reasonable comparison to address that. And again, I don't think that it's looking from system-wide QI, we wouldn't necessarily be considering individual calls, but looking at how much they're skewing response times in general. So expecting that you might have further questions about that after we spoke yesterday, I just did a comparison. I apologize, I couldn't get the presentation, but I was just doing this morning.
Thank you.
July to December of 2018, which is when, from our understanding, the new staffing pattern here in the healthcare district was really formalized. I know it had been kind of played with before, but that's when it was really formalized. Comparing July through December 2018 response numbers to July, December of 2017. So similar time frame, seems reasonable to consider that the study populations are represented and similar to each other. The only difference being that the staffing pattern here in the healthcare district was different. And this is again for code 3 responses and into Cambria specifically. And it's inclusive of any responses that were done by San Luis Ambulance for those time frames. For the July through December 2018 response period, which was a total of 345 calls that we could query in our data set, the average response time was 6 minutes and 10 seconds, the median was 5 minutes and 46 seconds, and the 90th percentile was 9 minutes and 34 seconds.
And what time of day was that?
This is for all calls, irrespective of time.
Okay.
And for the same time period in 2017, we didn't see any significant change. Specifically, the total call volume that we could query in the database and work with was 255 calls. The average response time for all those calls was 6 minutes and 4 seconds. The median was 6 minutes flat. And the 90th percentile was 10 minutes flat. So we see between the median and the average some variation amongst each other. Again, I'd venture to say we can't really run statistics off of just two numbers, but I doubt there's statistical significance between them since the average went up slightly, the median and the 90th percentile actually went down a little bit. So again, it's a valid comparison to compare time of day, but the call volumes that occur specifically of San Jose Ambulance responding into an area start to make that a little trickier, and that's something that I just didn't have time to look more into and break down further my time of day.
Because, you know, that is a big area of decision for us in the next few months to evaluate what kinds of potential solutions there might be to problems if they're identified,
right.
And this it would be helpful if we could maybe offline work on that somehow to better focus our understanding of the risk we're taking. Most of us are pretty low risk people,
risk averse.
And obviously in this business you have to tolerate a certain amount of risk, but there may be some creative solutions, but we don't want to make solutions to things that aren't problems. We want to know for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the best I can say is that from a system perspective, right, in looking at bulk numbers system-wide, we can't say thus far that we're picking up a significant difference or a change in those two time sets. It does often, as you just came back to, the degree to which people are willing to accept risk and the public perception of risk. I can just speak about, you know, it's not necessarily from a QI standpoint, but amongst EMS coordinators and administrators across the entire state and across the entire country, there's a lot of discussion going on as well that there's no actual hard evidence showing that response times very well correlate to actual patient outcome in general, with the small exception of cardiac arrest patients and choking patients, which are a very small subset.
And maybe stroke patients.
And stroke patients as well. We're going to get into some discussion scene times, and I include stroke patients with that as well, yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion across the state and across the nation of finding ways to balance efficiency of systems, because it is, as we've already talked about, getting increasingly difficult to run an efficient system that is, you know, affordable and that still provides the level of service that can be done. And one of the facets that's discussed with that is that there is not a very good correlation between response times, but rather that's something that I think for reasonable reasonable reasons the public expects quick response times. And of course that's valid as well. That's going to have to be balanced out in making these decisions, is public expectation of response times. But there's not a lot of data that necessarily correlates that to actual patient outcomes in most all cases. And again, looking at it from a system standpoint, that's kind of where I have to stick, is looking at the big picture numbers, if you will.
But what I struggle with, and not to belabor this too much, is that in a town where your statistics are pretty small, no matter what, it's very difficult to know if, for example, your stroke victims, people who awaken at 4 in the morning with a stroke and their partner discovers it, if those numbers are good or bad, or the number of people who have an acute MI, you know, at 2 in the morning, it's a pretty small number in Cambria. If it's my number, it's a pretty important number.
Of course, yeah.
So, but I, because we're small, I at some point would like to understand better how we can, maybe it's a case study analysis, to really drill down and understand if our current system is giving these residents their best chance.
Yeah, no, and I think it's a very important and valid thing to look at further. I'd encourage the board to work with the administrator and operations director, and of course we'll be available to work with them and provide any data if they don't have access to the data. But I think that's something that being specific to the healthcare district and a specific question to the healthcare district would be a very valuable thing for the board to work with the administrator and operations director on to flush out further. And by all means, reach out to us and give us a call if you need our help in getting data or have questions related to it.
Thank you.
Just sir. Want to go back and make sure I understand. Your comparison of the before and the after the schedule change.
Yes, sir.
You found no statistical difference in response times between those two periods.
Yes, sir. That's correct. Any other questions on that? Thank you. It's an important discussion, so I'm happy to take questions. Thank you. Okay. Moving on then, we have scene times. And I'm going to have two slides with this. This first one is a comparison of scene times, which we find as from the time that the ambulance crew document they made patient contact to the time that they left to transport the patient to the hospital. So this is only for transported patients. And again, we have a comparison of healthcare district ambulance calls versus county-wide. And we can see that there's a pretty sharp point around 10 to 14 minutes. I believe, if I remember correctly, it was right about 12 minutes, right in the middle there, of median scene time. And that's for all urgent calls that were transported to the hospital. Now, similar to how in a management of ambulance systems, we, you know, frequently look at shoot times, we look at response times, and we just look at scene times. I'd speculate, though, I'll go ahead and just say my opinion is that we should spend less time looking at scene times for all scene calls and really focus our attention on scene times in the small group of patients that we know benefit from rapid transport to the hospital, because that is not actually the majority of calls that we run 911 calls on. A lot of these folks, actually, they may even benefit from a detailed assessment and workup at their house before being transported. Some even very sick patients, like cardiac arrest patients, there's lots of research that has shown that they actually benefit from the crew taking 20, 30 minutes to stay in the residence and perform all the care there before they take them to the hospital. So with that in mind, I ran the second set of numbers, which is specifically for scene times in trauma patients that had emergent transport to the hospital, so where the crew got on scene, they determined their injuries were significant enough that it warranted emergent transport to the hospital, and stroke patients that had emergent transport to the hospital. It's a small selection of the population, so not representative. There certainly could be other patient populations that should be put into that as well, but it was just pulling out a group that we can definitely make the argument these people benefit from a shorter scene time and rapid transport to the hospital. And for that patient population, you see the county-wide statistic of scene time actually stayed pretty much the same as where it was previously. But I'm happy to say the healthcare district ambulance calls actually had a bit of a leftward shift, indicating that they did have shorter scene times in general on those critical patients and getting them to the hospital. Did that make sense before I move on? Because I know...
But is that a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a good thing, yes, sir. So I would eventually say it's a good thing.
Okay.
Okay, moving on to a breakdown of the type of complaints that patients transported by the healthcare district presented with. This first statistic is a very blunt number, and here's where we get into a little bit of the difficulty in collecting data between the two electronic health record systems that we have across the year. This breakdown between medical adult and peds, trauma adult, trauma peds, is one that previous presentations have been given to this board using, so I kind of stuck with that for the sake of familiarity in comparison to previous years. It's obviously a very blunt dissecting tool in breaking down the type of patients that were involved. And these particular definitions of patients are ones that were very easily assigned and then extracted in the Simon Nomis platform. The ImageTrend platform does not have these direct comparisons. I would actually say that they have a much higher fidelity ability to break down and determine the nature of the patient complaints than in the Simon Nomis platform. So I did my best with this figure. This is inclusive of all calls 2018, Simon Nomis, and ImageTrend. I had to do some work to try and reconcile them into the same categories. But I put that out there to say that I would not be willing to assign statistical significance to these numbers. I think that they are accurate ballpark figures for the categories, but I can't promise that there weren't some cases that may have fallen outside of that. And they do compare very closely to previous years, which lends me to all more say that I think that they're probably good estimates. So that being said, we have 87% of the patients that healthcare district ambulance is sponsoring transport to the hospital were adult medical patients. Aside from that, we had 11% of patients were adult trauma patients, and in general, very small percentages were pediatric patients. And again, this is where I get to being honest about the statistics as we're presenting them. Though these came out as 0% trauma pediatric patients, I'm not willing to actually say that there were no calls that happened with healthcare district ambulance in 2018 where they responded to a pediatric having trauma. But that was some artifact of the data, and I do think it's safe to say that however many there were, it was a very small number. I threw in this age distribution and this breakdown that we have of adult medical versus adult trauma. The percentage of adult trauma and adult medical as compares to countywide is a bit higher, adult medical compared to adult trauma. I don't have that number available off the top of my head. I apologize, but I remember historically across the years, looking back longitudinally previous years, it's typically been a little bit higher compared to the countywide numbers as well. it's likely that that is due to the general age distribution of people that are calling for ambulance service in the healthcare district compared to the county, which is skewed a bit rightward, as you can see in this graph, the distribution of patients' age ranges that call for healthcare service in the healthcare district. And it's got a sharp increase from 50 to about 100. And that is somewhat representative of the EMS patients in general. Of course, older folks tend to have more medical problems and they call for EMS service more frequently, but it is skewed a little bit more upward and rightward than other areas.
We don't know if it's the water or the air, but we have a very large percentage of octogenarians who are quite healthy in Cambria.
Yeah.
I mean, more than larger percentage than normal.
Yeah. Well, it's a great community, and if I had the option to retire here, I'd choose that, so that might just be part of it as well. Further breakdown of the medical complaints census. 87% of the calls were for adult medical patients, and so a bit of a breakdown of some points of interest. Obviously, this is not inclusive of all the adult medicals. It's not statistic. The total distribution, it's just a count of several interesting categories. And these are not statistics, they're actually the raw numbers from the data set that I was able to pull from, and it did was from a combination of both Simon Illness and ImageTrend, so for the entire year. We had in healthcare district area, we had 8 cardiac arrests where resuscitation was actually attempted, so there was a handful more where the patient had been deceased too long and the crew using their medical evaluation when they got seen determined that resuscitation wouldn't do any good. But there were 8 where resuscitation was attempted, and I kind of jumped, and that's down at the bottom, I apologize for the ordering. I'll jump back up to that first category, 2, ROSC patients. And if anybody's not familiar with that acronym, that's return of spontaneous circulation. So what that means is of those 8 cardiac arrest resuscitations that were attempted, 2 of them, the crews were successful in getting pulses back, transported to the hospital. They've actually occurred fairly recently. And so we're still waiting on some outcome data for some of them, but I can speak to at least one of those had even a positive outcome after getting to the hospital, and they were discharged and doing quite well. Those numbers are small, but 2 out of 8 is good numbers. I mean, that's yeah, it's for those of us that have been around the business for a long time, we know that out-of-hospital cardiac arrests up until just recent history almost never had people actually successfully resuscitated and then actually discharged from a hospital successfully and neurologically intact as well. Countywide, we've implemented protocols of high-performance CPR, stressing, as I mentioned earlier, protocols where the crews actually stay on scene to do good treatment before they transport to the hospital. And countywide, including in the healthcare district, we've noticed that that's increasing our rate of successful resuscitations where crews get ROSC and the patients have a good subsequent outcome. That's reflected in those 2 numbers. And that's something that countywide, I think, our community and in the healthcare district as well, we should be really proud of. So we're doing very good with that. Moving on to other
medical. Is there any way we could go back and look at what the response times were in the spontaneous return of circulation, for example, or say the stroke cases, that just to understand, because one thing I think is that when you find out if it's a frequent flyer kind of patient and it's dropped out of bed, the person's fallen out of bed, mm-hmm. versus being told that it seems like an acute MI, it might change human behavior in terms of speed and risk to get on scene.
Yeah, it may. And that is something that, yes, is certainly doable. Again, I'd venture to say that would be a good project to work with the administrative staff on that. And, of course, if there's a difficulty in getting the data, we'll be happy to help with that. But I think it is something that's valuable to look at, for sure. And that is something that's, being familiar with the databases, it is possible to do that. The other categories, some 19 strokes, 9 STEMIs, so that's STL elevation myocardial infarctions, and then a new category that hasn't been discussed in these presentations to the board before, 12 consults. So in 2018, the healthcare district and other transport ambulances across the entire county got the ability, and we implemented a protocol by which they can actually transmit their 12-lead EKGs, the most important diagnostic tool in determining if someone is having an emergent heart attack or not. They can now transmit those 12-lead EKGs directly to the hospital and consult with the physician in determining if it is a emergent heart attack or some other condition. So historically, we just looked at what were STEMIs, and now with this new protocol, we also get 12-lead consults. And countywide, we're still working on determining our protocols, how to best sort out our definitions of these two populations, because there's a lot of overlap, of course. There's the ones where the crew says, yes, I'm confident, I know that this is an emergent heart attack, and I'm documenting it as a STEMI and transporting them emergently. And then there are other ones where they're like, I'm suspicious, and I'm continuing my emergent transport, I'm doing all of that care, but in the meantime, I'm doing a 12-week consult, and they document it as that. So those two populations that you see there are closely linked together. It may even be a fair thing to say that they were really kind of the same population. These were folks that were presenting with symptoms that made the crew suspicious that they may be having a heart attack. But of course, not all of the 12-lead consults ended up having STEMI. So that's why I presented the two numbers differently.
Knowing how busy ERs are, is there ever difficulty getting that 12-lead consult quickly?
That is something that, this being a somewhat new program that we are continuing to work with, and to give you a completely honest answer, I think that sometimes there is. That does, of course, run into a bit of difficulty then with, hospital administration. Everybody's, of course, defensive of their people, and when we have conversations with them about that, they tell us that there's no problem at all. We hear anecdotal stories that there may have been a problem, so that's an ongoing project that we're working to streamline and work on. But I would say, again, it's anecdote, but my perception, and I believe the perception of most of the paramedics and the crew, is that this has definitely been a positive thing that's improved care overall. We still have room for improvement. It's an ongoing project at the county level that we're working on. But there's always room for improvement. And then we had shortness of breath on 21 as well. One of the board members contacted me and posed a specific question that had been raised by a member of the community about behavioral emergencies. I didn't have time to do a deep dive into that patient population, but I did get some quick numbers per your guys' requests for that. And of course, I did not have the presentation, but I can tell you I have them recorded here. And this is data that's only from the image trend data set, so from March of 2018 through the end of the year. Okay. And that's again because image trend enables us to search and query things more specifically than the old Simon Lewis platform allows us to. So in Cambria and San Simeon area, I include kind of the broader response area, it didn't include Monterey County. There were 37 patients, and this is out of a total of 730 records for calls in those areas, where the provider on the ambulance, the paramedic, documented a primary or secondary impression that they had their clinical impression of the patient of behavioral psychiatric disorder, suicide attempt, or generalized anxiety disorder. Of that set, the suicide attempt, that was one patient that was documented as such. I had cautioned when I talked to the board member about this that querying suicide attempts specifically may be more difficult because suicide attempts often get documented as something else. Just because, if it's a suicide attempt from ingestion of pills, for example, mm-hmm. it may be documented as just ingestion, poison, overdose, instead of suicide attempt. If it's an attempt by, lacerating yourself, cutting your wrist, it may be documented as an impression based on the injuries. So that becomes a harder data set to query. But those are some rough numbers. Let's see, I did some others with that. So that, for that patient population that I was able to look at over that time frame in Cambria and San Simeon, that comes out to be about 5% of calls. countywide comparison, just to give it some perspective. Obviously, the numbers for the entire county are much larger. There were 478 calls documented countywide, similar nature. I had to query that in Simon Nomis, so the breakdown of description of the calls got a little bit different, but I did my best to correlate them as best I could. And that came out to be about 2% out of the total call. So I would caution with those numbers, 37, that saying that there's an actual difference between 2% and 5% would be, I have doubts that there's statistical significance between those two. I didn't have the time at this point to actually do a statistical comparison to validate that, but I would just caution the board before thinking that there's that the 5% is a truly higher number, that they are statistically, with only 37 patient records that we're talking about, may not be all that different. Mm-hmm.
I'm the one who requested that information. I appreciate you doing that. So is there a way of teasing out if these calls are for our homeless population versus people who have, you know, a residence?
Yeah, that's something that certainly could be done. Again, it would require a deeper dive into the data. And that's something that I enjoy discussing these things with you guys, because you guys are asking questions that are near and dear to my heart, because being a QI guy, I'm always like, yes, I want to dig deep and get all these great answers, but of course then that just becomes a balance of time and trying to figure out things from the entire system. So that's something that we could certainly talk about in the future and maybe work on collaboratively and look at. Obviously, mental health issues and how healthcare industry as a whole is a hot button issue, and one that's probably been underrecognized and not dealt with much historically. And I think, again, this is just me speaking opinion, but there certainly seems to be a bit of a sea change in past years that we're finally, as a society in general, recognizing that and recognizing that there are things that we need to do about. So these would be great things to study more in the future, and that's something that we could work on and discuss at a future point in time.
I know all towns, all cities have some issues with access to behavioral health support, but I think that the more rural the town, the more concern we have that we may need to find a more creative way to bring in support for folks who can't just tootle over to San Luis for their weekly appointment or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's a valuable mission and something worth exploring further, for sure. Any other questions on that?
Yeah.
So moving on, just the breakdown of calls. Obviously, the response to trauma calls and transport trauma patients was much lower than the medical, but a little bit of a breakdown. So there were 92 patients in the data set that I could query of adult trauma patients in general. 70 calls of the trauma calls specifically were for ground level falls. And that is a number that is high across the entire county, 70 out of 92. Again, when we get to these numbers being so small, it's hard to do a true comparison to say for certain, but 70 does seem to be a bit higher. And again, I would speculate, it's just speculation, that that may be due to the skewness of patient population in healthcare district. And then 31 of those 92 calls met county trauma criteria, which is... safe to say, I think the paramedic provider impression, based on their assessment, indicated that these were probably higher acuity patients, and they met county designated criteria for them to either transport directly to the trauma center and not a general hospital, or at least call the trauma center and consult with the physician and staff there and see if they should transport to the hospital.
How do you define a fall as a trauma? What would a fall have to be like for it to be a trauma fall?
Well, these are defined in pretty broad terms of just if the crew documented that their impression was that they had a traumatic injury, which could be anything. That could range from a scratch or a bruise up to major trauma. And then secondarily, if they documented that the mechanism by which they got that injury was some type of a fall. And it covers a whole gamut of falls, which the list of provider impressions to describe falls is quite lengthy. And so we just go through and select the ones that are related to what you would expect to be kind of normal daily activities. So exclude things like they fell off a cliff, but include all the ones that, you know, are trip, stumble falls, stumble fall over a curb, stumble and fall, getting into or out of the tub, all of those things are what we define as the groundable fall. Okay, moving on. And this, if anybody recalls last year's presentation, maybe a slide that warrants some more explaining or discussion. I compared to previous year's numbers, and things looked a bit different. So I'll talk about that in a second, but I'll start with just discussing what I was able to determine from the records about our vascular access success rate, so IV success rate of healthcare district ambulance crews on calls. For 2018, and this is inclusive of both records, Simon Nomis and Image China, the data that I was able to query demonstrated that there was a 69% success rate of vascular access attempts. And then per patient, because some patients receive multiple attempts at vascular access, per patient, the success rate was 73%. So out of total times that, from what I can tell in the data, while the healthcare district ambulance paramedics attempted to start an IV, they were successful 69% of the time. Patient-wise, of all the patients that they attempted vascular access on, they were successful 73% of the time. Because of some complications in querying the data, I didn't have the chance to, it would have just taken more time, but I didn't have to dive deeper into 2018 to do a side-by-side comparison for the entire county, but I could look at the past raw numbers from 2017 and do a county-wide analysis, and which is probably a reasonable comparison unless we think that our paramedics have specifically changed in how they're starting IVs from 2017 to 2018. In 2017, the countywide success rate by attempt was 54%. This is something that, as I was querying, so I wanted to present these numbers to you guys because it's something that has been presented in these past meetings. But as I was diving into this data, I encountered a number of questions which they were basically confounders that made an analysis. I had more questions than answers about the validity of the data. And a lot of this was in how the data is documented. There's no reason to think that it's any type of data collection error, that the crews are doing a bad job of documenting their attempts and their success rate, but rather the data collection, the data points in the old Simon Nomis platform don't give a very clear representation for comparing successes and not successes with this. And that's something that's improved in the image trend platform, so I think we'll have better statistics going forward. But to try and keep it brief, the paramedic can either, in the old platform, they can either document when they write in on the computer, I attempted an IV and I was successful with it with this many attempts, and therefore those attempts would have been unsuccessful attempts beforehand. Or they can document in, I attempted an IV and I was unsuccessful. And the way the data comes out on the other side for us to query from that, you can't differentiate between those two very well. It just shows up as one bulk number. And so the previous year's data gave a much higher statistic for success compared to this one that we have now. There was, when I reviewed, I had those raw numbers from the previous year's data, not just the presentation that you saw, but the raw numbers, and I'm certainly not willing to say that 63% represents a decrease from what happened last year. I think, to be honest with you guys, I think that the number that was reported last year, through malicious intent or anything, but I think it was wrong. I think it was calculated incorrectly. And I think that we're on track to be able to collect this statistic better because of the questions that arose and how the data was collected. I presented a statistic because I think the statistic is probably a better estimation compared to just the raw numbers, since there was questions about it. And again, I anticipate that moving forward with one single EHR platform, we'll be able to collect the statistics even better in the future.
So one of the things I've noticed is that we have a fair percentage of folks who are getting cancer treatment or other kind of treatment and have ports.
Yes.
And I don't know if we have all the right equipment available to us to access ports rather than to try IVs.
Yeah. And I can talk about several things for that, and I'll be happy to just point out and tell you, to some degree, I agree with you. There's some other considerations which I'll come back to with that. But one of my goals and longstanding objectives with the MS agency, where we create the protocol by which our field personnel can actually do their treatment, is to expand protocol to enable our medics more ability to do just that. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's a worthy objective that we all, if a person doesn't need to get stuck by a needle, they can still get the same level of care without being stuck by a needle. That's a good thing to do.
You can't get an IV in, but you could have succeeded with the port that was already there.
Yes. There are some other considerations, though, one of which is, I'm sure you, with your background, are familiar with the fact that, you have different types of ports, which include subcutaneous ports versus central lines that, PICC lines and central lines that actually have external pigtails. Mm-hmm. Accessing subcutaneous ports is something that it would require special equipment, but on top of that, that's actually something that is excluded from the state scope of practice, and it's not an option for paramedics. Accessing any one of the tunneled type of ports or catheters that come out in a PICC line or a central line that comes out externally, that is something that is allowed by state scope of practice. It doesn't actually require special equipment either. And it does require a little knowledge, which paramedics do receive in paramedic school. But then, again, going back to kind of my long-term objective, I think that we can just address that better in our county policy and in training with our paramedics so that they feel more enabled and feel like they have the cognitive tools to do that. So that is an objective for the long-term future. But again, in balancing objectives, I can't promise that's going to happen next month or even this year, but I'm hopeful.
Would it be possible if we chose for something like that this might not be the one, but for us to have our own training for our own staff to make sure we do it?
There is not. So when I talk about amending and updating the county policy to enable them to do this, I can be specific, actually, that right now it is not prohibited that they do it in county policy. And so they can do it. I think that most of our field staff, through no fault of their own, don't realize that, because while it's not prohibited in county policy, it's not also explicitly written into county policy. So mm-hmm. it's not really their fault. I would say that's a shortcoming of our policy.
Well, none of this is about fault. It's about creating solutions.
Well, I'm happy to take blame when it's appropriate for our agency. But again, just honest and transparency. So it's something that I think from the county for development of our policies, it's something we can improve on. If we don't like to use the fault word.
Maybe we could be a test site since because of our age range, we do have a higher use of these PICC lines, for lack of a better.
No, I think that would be a great thing and a really valuable thing. And it would be great for a test site because it is small. There's a smaller mm-hmm. number of medics that we could focus on education and training with. And I think that's a great idea for the future. I just request that if the board directs, and I'm sure the administrative staff would, but if you direct your administrative staff to take that on, that they do tie in with us because it does come into issues of medical control, which goes mm-hmm. back to our office and the county medical director. So just to make sure that we're all on the same page.
Well, and if we do that and that we do learn from that, then we would want to share it with
them. It'd be a good launching point for moving on for the entire county. Absolutely. Yeah, it's very good.
Cool.
Any other questions on that slide? Since again, I know the numbers came across a little weird with that. So. Other skills, and just in brief, and again, with the call volume, there's not a lot of other skills. The numbers are pretty small. So for 2018, inclusive of both data sets, there were some challenges in actually getting these numbers out. So these are the cases that I could find. And I've actually already talked with the operations director specifically about with one of these procedures, it was more difficult than it should be to get the data out. And it's just an easy behind-the-scenes tweak in the programming of the EHR, I think. And I've already spoken with him about that as I discovered the difficulty with it. But these are the best numbers I can come up with. For intubations performed by healthcare district ambulance paramedics in 2018, there were two attempts and two successes. And that's great numbers. One of those attempts, so two patients, two intubations, one of them did require two visualizations. So they had to look once, they couldn't get the tube in on the first one because they had to do additional suction or whatever the case may be. But then by the time they looked again, they were able to place the tube successfully. There were three attempts and three successful placements of intraosseous needles. Patients that they couldn't get vascular access on with an IV, and so they resorted to an IO, or an intraosseous needle instead. CPAP, three uses, and three uses seemed to go well with no complications. Needle decompressions, which is a very rarely used skill on the slide, I listed it as one patient, just because discussing it as far as successful or not, I think is easier to just discuss. So it was one patient who was in cardiac arrest in consultation with medical control, the paramedic, basically as a rule out of other causes, did two bilateral needle decompressions on the patient. So it was two decompressions, but only one patient. The procedure was probably successful. There was no indication that the needle were placed incorrectly, but the patient did remain deceased. So whether we call that successful or not is open to your interpretation. But there's no reason to think the paramedic didn't perform the procedure correctly. And that is the end of my presentation. So are there any other questions?
I have two more questions. Yeah. Sorry. I understand that there is a trend in looking at response data that is toward having the ER staff evaluate the quality of patient care en route. Where are we at, in the county in that process of getting to that point where we would be looking at those kinds of questions?
Well, I think that, I'll be honest, I'm not familiar with that per se of the ER staff directly feeding back on the quality of care. What I'm familiar with is, in general, an emphasis on correlating pre-hospital care to overall outcome. And of course, I think we're talking about one and the same. And that's something that we are working on. Of course, that starts to involve data sharing and exchange between a lot of different agencies and a lot of different entities with different HIPAA concerns, and it gets complicated and difficult. One of the things that we are using to get progress on this is further and further integration with electronic healthcare records. And that's kind of, I would say, the single biggest thing that is a project that we're working on to further incorporate that data, to make it a seamless exchange of data from the field to the hospital and then to us after the fact, and the administrative staff at agencies as well, for review. And statewide, there's a lot of effort going on to improve that. One of the steps with that was the driving force behind all these HR upgrades that I started talking about at the beginning of the presentation. And I think we're still working out the hiccups and road bumps of just migrating to these new EHR platforms. And once we get that worked out, it's going to enable us to further dive into reconciling provider impressions, diagnosis, overall patient outcome across the entire continuum of care, which I think touches on what you were talking about. Locally, in a more specific patient population set, I think that we are at system-wide level, we have specific patient population sets that we are doing that for. And this is specifically our cardiac arrest patients, our STEMI patients, and our trauma patients that meet county trauma criteria. And where we are looking to go in the future and progress with that, as you were asking about, is we're currently getting that feedback from how it went in the field to the hospital staff's impression and how it went in the hospital and patient outcome. I was literally just talking with one of our committees yesterday about this. What I'm working on is closing that gap and then getting that feedback back out to the field and the agencies where it can really be used for education and total system improvement. Because it's all well and good that we hear about it and find out the answers, but of course that doesn't help our medics out in the field get the feedback and know how they did and areas that they could improve or areas that they're doing great. So that's where it's something that we're working on.
Okay, two more quick questions. You can answer them shorter if you want, because okay. I don't not want to take over. But
I'll switch to yes, no.
Yes, no. Is there anything innovative going on in stroke care in the field? There's so much I read about, and I don't know how the county's doing.
Yeah, I guess the short answer would be yes. But I'll still expound on that a little bit. So on numerous levels, One, the regulatory level, I'll kind of start with that. At the state level, the state is poised to pass new stroke regulations for a continuum of stroke care and designation of stroke center hospitals. Previously, you may have heard hospitals talking about being stroke centers and stroke center designations, but that's not something that's been codified in regulation until now. And that's going to be a good launching platform for further development of a stroke system of care, analogous to the trauma system of care that you guys are probably more familiar with, because that has been put into regulations for a while, and that's given us a good launching pad for that. So we're working on that as we speak. You may have heard that Sierra Vista recently acquired ability to perform a procedure called thrombectomy, which is a select surgical procedure that's appropriate for some stroke patients, and that's an important distinction to make, that it's appropriate for just some stroke patients, not all. And so that's something that countywide we're also looking at and evaluating if there's going to be any need to change our pre-hospital care now that we have that ability here in our county. That being said, I would caution you guys, I always caution folks when I discuss that to not jump the gun and assume that it will impact pre-hospital care. Because when you really dive into the data, while thrombectomy is a great tool for a select number of stroke patients, there's not a lot of evidence thus far that indicate that it's the number of patients it benefits is worth changing the pre-hospital care to get them there. So something we're evaluating, and we're going to be continuing to evaluate and working with Sierra Vista, and we'll be looking at it a lot over the next few years.
Okay, my last question.
Yeah.
So this kind of presentation is really great, really helpful. I really appreciate everything you did on it. Does San Luis Ambulance get the same sort of analysis, or do they ask for it, or do they get it? And I'm not asking this in a competitive way, but I'm wondering, since we're just a tiny percentage of the total.
Yeah. And the short answer is no. So you guys are actually the only agency that we're currently doing this for. And that's
is there going to be a bill?
No, unfortunately, I wish if I got to bill for more for my things, then I'd be making a whole lot more money than I currently do. But no, that's not something that other agencies get. Other agencies do, well, how to put this? A perception that I have is that they like to do their own QI and review of system in-house. Now we consult with them, agencies, all of them, including your guys' operations director, participate in our EMS agency QI group, in which we do discuss these system-wide things and system-wide trends, and as we evaluate things, we discuss them with that group for them to then take back to the agency. But when it comes into getting into specifics, like response times and success rates with IVs and everything, we certainly look at and monitor these things, but other agencies, they like to look at and monitor them themselves, independent from us. And then that way, if we ever come to them and say, hey, let's talk about your response times, they're like, well, we already have our response time data, and then we can compare notes, if that makes sense.
Okay, thank you.
I have one question. Is there a statistic captured that basically is a transportation that's not medically necessary?
I think the short answer for that is no. And that's something that is, I think, difficult to ascertain with any high degree of confidence, right? Because when we look at pre-hospital data, of course, we have to gauge that off one prior impression. And of course, our medics across the entire county, they're very good at their jobs, and they're well-educated, they're well-versed in it. But the very nature of EMS is that we don't necessarily always have the full picture either. And so, you know, one thing where comparing the provider's impression in the field, when they get to the hospital, through nobody's fault, that impression may change. And so that's one area where it's very difficult to draw that comparison. And then the other one, of course, is just societal expectations and determining what's a medical necessity for an ambulance transport. I think it gets tenuous trying to pin that down because, of course, what I consider to be medically necessary versus what you consider to be medically necessary versus what any random patient considers to be medically necessary, we're going to come up with three different definitions. So it'd be great if we could, but again, short answer is no.
Any other questions?
No. But thank you.
Thank you guys.
Yeah, tremendous. I really appreciate it a lot.
No problem. Thank you. Shall I turn this off?
Yes.
You're welcome to stay, and you're welcome to ask us questions on things if you want.
I would like to, but I'm afraid I just got other things at the office that are calling me that I got to get back to, so I'll shut this down.
Now, I realize.
I want to remind you that you need to go back.
That's what I was just going to say. Yeah. Two things. I was in such a hurry to, so excited to hear the presentation, that I believe on item 4D that we should have a motion to actually hire our new administrator.
I'd like to make a motion that we hire Maureen Wilson as the district's administrator for the next year.
I second that.
Any discussion? Any public comment before we vote? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? I'll say aye. Thank you. The other thing I neglected to do was to report out of closed session, and we had a very busy December. Closed session on December 12th, there was no reportable action. December 18th, excuse my notes here, there was no reportable action. And on December 28th, the board directed the executive committee to work with Jeff Minnery and Maureen Robles Wilson to develop a contract for the district administrator position. We shall now move on. Public comment for items not on the agenda. And there being none, we move to the consent agenda. Does anyone have anything they would like pulled to discuss or question?
I would like to pull item B, the financial and budget analysis.
And anybody else? I need to pull C and I believe A. So under what we will do is ask our questions and then go back and approve the entire group together. Under item 6A, the ambulance activity report, I had a quick question. It's on page 12 of the packet, and that was whether it would be possible on the dual call page for us to have the same information on that page as we have in our regular activity page, which would give us a little more information for these dual calls. And
I can't answer that, so we'll just have to pass that to the IT tech and the operations director.
Perfect. Thank you. Moving to 6B, Bill.
A couple of questions. What is the current status of the GEMT field? Maybe that's the wrong word. The auditor came in and was apparently using a different set of criteria versus previous auditors, and they rejected a number of our filings that was going to go to an administrative judge or hearing, and we were waiting for the how that was finalized.
So the 1314 GEMT continues to be discussed. Each party has a certain number of days to respond. We responded and with what we felt was the amount of dry runs that we define as a dry run that we believe is the correct definition. We sent that very small group of PCRs, plus we sent all of the dry runs. Now it is up to the auditor to make his presentation to your judge. The judge will let us know when that happens. I think he has a few more days, and then we will have another conference call to hear the judge's opinion and have him make some sort of ruling about what he feels the correct definition is and what we'll agree to as far as how many patient care reports we have to support for that this year.
So in the next month, we would have a better idea.
I would hope so. I would hope so.
Okay. Next question is, have we ever received the payment for the new ambulance from Project Heartbeat?
Project Heartbeat said they sent it, and we never received it. And Don Malendi reached out to them, and from what I understand, after the new year, they were going to reissue a new check.
And as of today, we haven't received it.
I'm sorry. We're talking about... I'm confusing this. I'm sorry. Project Heartbeat is the 39,000. So you're talking about the interest on the money that we have in the Community Foundation, the $39,000? Is that what you're talking about?
Right. That they said that they would send us for the new ambulance.
So we received, prior to you coming on the board, a check for $39,000 for, and that's been about 4 months ago. I'm actually talking about the money that we asked for from, I believe it was either CAN or, I can't remember the other group, that check was lost in the mail. But yes, we received $39,900 over 4 months ago.
Was it in this fiscal year?
Yes.
I'm having difficulty identifying that in the budget analysis report.
Well, I would imagine that's probably because I was asked to not put it. So the budget analysis and the financials are in office documents. So that's just to make sure that we can balance the checking account. For instance, the I was going to talk about stipend. The monthly financial report shows a reimbursement check from SDRMA for moving expenses. That is journaled against our actual moving expenses. But it's showing as income because we put it into the bank, and of course we want to come to the correct number with our statement and with the CPA. At this point, with everything that's on, I can't exactly remember what happened with the $39,000, but I would imagine it went against Unit 19, which is a new entry in QuickBooks. So we have We have Unit 15, 16, 17, 18, and now we have 19. So that money went against the cost of Unit 19. I can research and tell you where it is in a journal entry, but off the top of my head right now, because I don't remember making that decision. I was asked to move that out, so it didn't look like we got that as income. You don't see it up here in the auxiliary miscellaneous. I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, operating revenue.
No.
But I do see down the bottom the expense related to the 19 two entries.
And these are items that weren't covered by any monies that we received. These are other things that have transpired since Unit 19 was delivered to us, some of the facility repair issues that, unfortunately, I really can't answer, but I know that they have existed. These are going to have down to 19 after we purchased it.
Okay, I'm still uncomfortable with how that all came together. Maybe after the meeting, give a call and talk with Maureen, kind of put it together. Because if the entries on the budget analysis report for Unit 19, which are $32,000, are in addition to the $39,000 that we purchased the unit for, it looks like the unit may have cost us, in round numbers, twice as much as we originally thought. And I just need to understand that.
Perhaps that's something that we can discuss once our new administrator gets a moment to take breath after she starts tomorrow and then during a financial meeting.
Good.
The committee meeting.
Thank you. Makes sense. Next question. The CSDA, that's the California Special District Association, which we paid $5,000 for. Question about understanding, what do we get for that, besides a membership?
I believe they would be the best people to answer that. SDRMA and CSDA work hand in hand, so I believe that you need to belong to both to receive the benefit, just like CCSD does, of being able to have them be the insurance carrier for work comp liability, etc. CSDA does most of the legislative work on behalf of districts, mm-hmm. special districts especially, in the state. But again, that would be a question best asked to the CSDA. But they do provide a great deal of legislative support. They have webinars that we take. I sent everybody a link for one of the webinars, AB1234. There's also sexual harassment. They offer all kinds of training. Much of it is free, but past that, I think it would be.
So what I remember about that is that the CSDA cost was basically in parallel reduced our SDRMA insurance, like if you were a member of CSDA, that we, so that there, it was almost, I wouldn't call it free, but I that was what I remember hearing. It might be good to check and see what the difference is, what we're actually getting, and whether the, you know, with the, if that ratio is still as good as it was a few years ago or not.
And my last question has to do on page 18 with the addendum to the budget analysis, where we're talking about legal fees. I see the December legal expense was $13,894, and you're reflecting $31,918, which was the last month's number. Was that just an oversight?
I think I just didn't change my numbers. So 31,916 paid almost in full everything we owed from last fiscal year, the PERV, all of the PERV issues, and then the new amount $13,894 is actually money that we owed for this fiscal year. So yes, that was a typo. I didn't change the number from one month to the other.
Now, the real question that I have about that is, are we caught up to date on legal fees to the best of your knowledge, meaning all last year's are now paid and we're current through current billings?
Well, unless they send us a bill, I think the last bill that we got was actually for November. So there's a great possibility that we are going to owe money for December.
Okay.
When you say they, which law firm are you talking about?
I'm assuming only Adamski, Morosky, Cumberland & Green, because we're not I'm not aware, but I'm not privy to that information. If anybody is dealing with, it's not Clifton Morrison now, but the other Chelsea's.
I have not been. But one thing that the Finance Committee might want to consider entertaining is whether we want a approach where the person or persons who talk with the legal staff or ask the legal staff for services would keep a contemporaneous log that could then be used to review the bills.
I think that might make sense. We'll put that on the agenda when the Finance Committee gets together. Now, Heidi, I have another overall question. Comparing the first 6 months of the previous fiscal year, July through December, to the first 6 months of this fiscal year, again, July through December, I'm looking for the impact of the change in the annual state. Previous year, for that first six-month period, we had the two full-time 24/7. And this year, we have, to make it easy, 1.5 ambulances. Okay? And I looked at the salary expense, full-time and part-time, and see that we have a little over 9% decrease in salaries, which makes sense. You should, with less service, you have less salaries. Okay, you know, right now it's 9.2%. I then looked at the benefits, the perks, the health insurance, Medicare, hospital, and I was expecting to see some sort of close correlation that if wages go down, those types of benefits go down. While the wages went down 9%, the benefits only went down 2.5%. And any thoughts on why there wouldn't be a closer correlation?
I feel like the administrator, but I can tell you why. So PERS goes up every year. So if somebody's making $10,000 a year and we're paying, the district pays on that tier, let's say it's tier one, 31%.
Sure.
If they're still paying $10,000 when the new rates go in, and that happens on July 1st, and the rates go up, then we pay on that. Although we do have the 12-hour car place, we've had two people leave, so we've had a lot of benefits that people have paid out. Mm-hmm. We actually had three people leave. We had a mass exodus of people. We also have a lot of people who took vacation. We've had people who've been sick. We had a work comp issue. Health benefits. So we actually have a person who's in our employ now who actually doesn't, has not accepted a health benefit, which is a real, wonderful thing for us. Mm-hmm. So we're saving money on that side. Now, let me make a point. What was my point? Last year, even though people didn't get raises, there were five employees who did get a raise. And that's based on one of them, because the employees, aside from myself, because I was pulled out of that group, they have a step schedule. So five people got raises last year. Because they would either hit a step, let's say they hit a 5-year step, a 10-year step, a 15-year step, or minimum wage went up. And we actually had one person who was an EMT who was making less than $11 an hour. So that's probably where you see your variance. Jason was here because what I was going to talk about when I talked about financials was that overtime costs, as you probably see on the bottom of the addendum, are much larger this year. We had full-time paramedic vacation and sick time. We had, by fault of no one, people calling on a Friday and not being able to come in for the next 3 days. And when that happens, you go to your part-timers, and most of your part-timers are already working, so you have full-timers to work, and that's a huge expense. He could talk about that, address that better than I am, but I did write a note that both part-time and full-time people filled in the shifts, and that's what's been happening for the last 6 months. So I think we'll see a better decrease in salaries once we get somebody into the positions that have been vacated. We have one that has been vacant for almost 3 months and has yet to be filled. We're doing some testing, I believe, it's here on the 30th, I think is the day. But it's been a roller coaster of Jason trying to fill shifts. And we don't do what a lot of agencies do, where they go to their full-timers first. We try to go to our part-timers first, because the cost of a full-timer is exponential.
Correct.
So, but benefit-wise, you know, we did have 5 people who had raises last year, and every time you get a raise, of course, then the percentage that the district pays on their behalf, depending on the tier there, goes up. We only have 3 people left in Tier 1, which is 3% at 50. We have 2 people in Tier 2, and then the rest of our safety employees are all in PEPRA. So that's a real savings for the district. The percentage there is excellent, but again, all the percentages went up in July. So, as I said, I wish Jason was here. I know he could give you some more insight into the scheduling, but it's not something that I do, but I can hopefully I give you some information.
When someone goes over a step, do they, at that point, do we change their salary? If someone gets it in April, to pick an example, do we start in April paying them the higher amount, or do we wait to the end of the fiscal year and pay them a lump sum? How does that work? Trying to understand the mechanics.
We start on that date. So for many of us, our first day was July 1st. Even if you've been here part-time. Back then, you know, normally you start on July 1st, but if your date, we have an employee whose first day was, I believe, March 1st, so on March 1st, if he gets to step 10, he gets a raise on that day for that time period.
Okay. Thank you, that's all I have.
Okay. Moving to the minutes, page 36, I had a couple quick questions. Tell me when you're ready. The person who spoke is Mark Cantor.
Oh, did you not? Oh, this is so. Lauren, we are very kindly. Let me know that. So, in the new packet that's on the website, I think I spelled it right. Kantnor?
Yes.
I think. So, you don't have the new, but it is on the website.
Okay. Perfect. All right. Good. So, I don't have to do that. And then on the next page, It's a small thing, page 37. It's the American Health Insurance portability, not potability. A little typo. And then, let's see. Below it says, Director Rice moved to accept the revision to the job description for the district administrator position. I think it means, I think what he moved was to accept the new job description. And that was where the confusion was
right.
In that conversation.
Okay. So you'd like it to be Director Rice to accept the new job description for the district.
Yeah, I think that's better. Oh, and back on page 36, right below Mark Cantor, there's a sentence that says, further board discussion followed with Director Fedoroff commenting on Trustee Putney's history on the board. And I'd like that sentence removed.
Okay.
Great. So if I think those are all of the questions, so if we could have a motion to approve the consent agenda A through D.
I'd like to make a motion to accept the consent agenda A through D.
I'll second.
Aye.
I'm sorry, who's my second?
I second because I realized we didn't second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Yep, no one left to oppose. Motion cleared. Passed. Hi, you're back on.
I just wanted to let you know operations director report that I did pass out. Operations director, Melinda asked me to make copies of these for you folks that are new on the board. Barbara's new for one is the AMR contract that we have with Monterey, and that covers the $1,500 that we get every time we get dispatched to Monterey County. The other is the contract between us and the County San Luis Obispo, and I do have a copy for the Marine back here. Let's see, we talked about a few items. As of today, we have about $15,000 in ambulance income, which is a little low for the middle of the month. But we have had 46 calls already this month. Wow. Since January 1st, there was another. 32 of them have been transports, and we've had 2 Monterey calls. So that's going to be great for our Monterey income. Yesterday, I did speak with Dennis Timney from SBRMA, and they are going to reimburse us for the cost of cleaning the Camborne House. So we should be getting that $600 back. Let's see. The audit has been completed. Leslie Moore will be sending out a draft in the next week, and she's able to present either February or March, depending on how much there is on the agenda. She's open to either, I believe it's the 20th on both days. So,
could you tell us a little bit about it? Did it go good? Did they have any concerns? Or?
We talk about many things as we go through the process. And they do, as you may or may not know, they ask for random items and checks. And she hasn't said that there have been any red flags. They're very thorough there. So I think I would wait to see if there is still that going concern when she sends the draft up. But she hasn't made any remarks to me, and I don't think that she had made any to Bob Sayers prior to his leaving. So after last year, when they gave us an idea of the expectation of how they would like things to be journaled, etc., and she said it was going to be this way, it was much easier this year than last year. And it's always harder the first year than another.
The concern I have is, are they again this year considering going concern?
She has not mentioned that to me. I don't know that.
Okay. What I'd like to see when she is ready is that she gives a draft of the full report that we can review for accuracy, because the report last year had some inaccuracies in it, even though when we pointed them out at a meeting, they never changed it. So something we need to think about is getting a draft of the report so that we can look at it and see if there's any concerns, so we can, if there is, hopefully we can deal with them in real time.
Yeah, I found a couple of things last year in the draft, and she said she would have that draft for us, I believe, within the next 14 days. So there should be enough time to review it prior to it being bound, and sent to us, or even before she comes to the meeting. Perhaps that would make it a better time for her to come in March. So if there are things...
What I prefer, Heidi, is if we find issues, that we have a dialogue with her, and if some of the numbers need to be adjusted, changed, or further explanation, that she does that in the draft that she presents to the board. So the document that the board gets is, if you will, the final document.
Okay, I will let her know that. And unless you have any other questions, I think I talked to Barbara about this, perhaps Barbara Moore in a meeting. So the CCSD was given many, many lots from the Land Conservancy, and that happened about 3 years ago. And when that happened, they did not make us aware of that, or me aware of that, Bob Sayers aware of that. Had they, I would have taken all of those ABN numbers off our tax rolls. But because, and they didn't take them off their tax rolls either. So not only did they pay the tax on retired lots, we sent them a bill and they paid us. And of course, as many of you know, in the last couple of years, there have been some changes in the CFO and financial folks that have been at CCSD. Now they have Al Labaste, who came back and helped, and he's the one who found this issue. So because I felt that it was unfair that they wanted us to pay in arrears 17 and 18, and then 18 and 19 amounts of over $3,000, officer at CCSP, and I explained that if I don't know that a number is bad, then there is no way that I can take it off our tax rolls. And the way I know a number is bad is that every year the county sends me a list. I go into the county and I go to the computer and I make those changes. Well, because they did not do that, not only to us but themselves, they paid a bill and they paid our bill, and now they want that money back. And I disagree with that, so I tried to take care of that prior to the new administrator coming, but they once I explained the actual process, which they didn't understand, I'm hoping that they will make a different determination, but we're going to have to work for administrator Bill Grace Wilson. We'll probably be really trying to. It's $3,000, but I think it's something that we shouldn't pay. And I made that clear. Had I been given the list that they just gave us, I would have just gone into our tax rolls. And I think it's simply a matter of them having a lot of turnover in their financial department. Nothing malicious. They certainly didn't want to keep them on their tax rolls and make them on theirs as well. So I will be dealing with that.
Is it a total of $3,000 or $3,000 for each of the years?
It's a little over $3,000 for 2 years. For both 17, 18, and then it was an oversight for that many months on their part. Because the only way that we know if a number is bad, if I have a tax roll program in my computer, and it's the same numbers every single year, unless you and your wife own a home and have a lot, and you decide to be able to pay taxes on both of them, you go to the county. I then go to the county because I get a list from the county, and they don't know, unless they get a list from CCSD, they don't know that those numbers have been retired. So there was no way for us not to bill them, because we didn't have the knowledge, neither did the county. And so that's why I'm asking that they forgive both the 17-18 and the 18-19 bill. If we don't have the information, we can't make a change.
Again, I'm sorry. Is it then $1,500 each year for a total of $3,000?
Correct. So
okay.
About $3,105.
Okay, that's right. I wasn't sure if it was $3,000, meaning $6,000.
That's all I have. Unless you have any questions.
Do you have any questions for Clayton? I have a couple of real quick ones. Did we ever get a security deposit back for Camborne?
We never paid a security deposit. Okay. I knew Phil and Maureen, and they said, we know where to find you.
Okay. I noticed on page 18 that we bought a lot of badges for staff. Looks like 11 badges at $108 each. Just so we understand cash flow better, could you explain why we would buy so many all at once? I'd probably a discount or something if you do, or?
So, again, I wish Jason was here, but I will tell you that six of those badges were purchased by employees. So $634.58 under the addendum, under uniform, is actually, you can take that out of the $1,181.61 for badges. So, especially in bigger systems, but in our system as well, when you go to the hospital, you know, you have new nurses in the ER, you have new staff, and they want to see a badge, and they want to see a name tag. That certainly makes you more official and more acceptable coming into their doors. And we were out of badges. So we had to, so I think we ordered 11. Six of them, people want their own badges. They don't want to leave them at work. We have a port cord, so if you're a paramedic, when you're done with your shift, you leave it, and the next day Lori comes in and she takes it.
So if they buy their own, they keep their own.
They keep their own.
So, but then, do we have that many employees?
We do think of, so people coming on and off. So some of the people that bought their own badges were part-timers. They just want their own badge with their own number. So Chad Lori will work once every 2 months. When he's gone, that badge is gone. So that probably, I don't know, I'm going to say that leaves maybe two or three badges on the board. So you have two EMTs every day and two paramedics every day. So, and we haven't ordered badges for quite a while. So we paid for, I believe, five of them. And they're
okay.
I think we've lost a couple in the past 4 or 5 years. And that's what happened.
Okay, so that's helpful. Is there a way we can get a more detailed analysis of overtime so that we can understand? Again, you might want to talk with Jason and with Maureen, but I'm hoping in the budget next year that we do get an overtime line in the budget analysis so that we it can be part of our budget and that we allocate money to it if that's appropriate. Okay. For the Finance Committee. What I noticed is that it's just the way it's presented. I don't know like why the difference. So, not for you to answer now, but it would be good if we could get a handle on overtime and so in a way where we could begin to reduce it intelligently. But we can't
ask a question. The dollar amount listed for overtime, is that half amount over, or does that include what the hourly would be plus the half?
So this overtime expense at the bottom of the addendum, that's FIC 2018, that includes I'll use Tim Bennis. So Tim Bennis has a set schedule, and he's paid, he's 24 hours, so he gets paid 87 hours at straight time and 35 hours of overtime. Anything he works over that is considered overtime, and he gets paid his time and a half rate.
No, but I guess what I'm trying to say is, and I think you just answered, when we look at that dollar amount, there's only one-third of it that's actually
premium.
Or one half of it, that's actually something you could have really saved. Does that, am I making my, in other words, if you're replacing a person who had worked straight time with a person who worked time and a half, the difference between those two, given the a rate difference between it is basically only a portion of that dollar amount that's reported. So it always looks much worse than it actually is. That was my only point.
And this also includes people who cash out some of their overtime. You know, somebody, and that's very rare. But we had a lot of overtime in December. We had sick people, and we had people who waited till the last minute, hoping that they would be okay to come in. And these you would vary because families and ambulance have the same tissue. So we had the same pickings, and that's what happened. So that's why we have so much more overtime this December than last December. And last December we had another full time paramedic, and this December we don't. That's why we're having our hiring number 30.
Now last December we had two ambulances on at night. So,
but we also had full time employees. And this year we have two slots that are being filled by part-timers. And a lot of them are being filled by full-timers because part-timers were working for people with sound and ambulance who were sick.
So it's for my part, when we talk about overtime, it's not to find fault like people are working overtime who shouldn't be. It's more to help us figure out ways to manage it and to also be able to plan for it in our budget so that we are do a slightly better job of making sure we're in the black.
It'd be nice to get a bigger pool of people. That's what we're going to try to get is a bigger pool of our timers through this hiring process.
So on page 20, my last question in this section is looking at the year-over-year difference on the accounts year-over-year. And I went back and I realized that we received this year $25,000 more in taxes at this time of year than we had last year. But then we're still behind. We're still, the difference is still quite large. So more to note it and to help us take a attitude towards the budget of understanding that just because it was allocated in the budget that it doesn't mean that we can spend it by category. I defer to the Finance Committee.
Your point is well taken. As you know, we have been concerned for a long, long time about the excess cash expenditure of the casualties. And anything that we can do to avoid a payment, an expense, we should always try to identify that, be it overtime or whatever. And this is not a criticism that you're not doing it. It's more a statement of the intent of the board is to reduce overtime and other types of expenses wherever possible. That I think we need to have a new mindset. I talked a little bit earlier about the California Society, Special Districts Association, okay? And we talked about that might be a good thing because it gives us some reduction. But every time we are presented with an opportunity to join something or renew a membership, we need to look long and hard about it to make sure that makes sense. That's what it's about.
I don't criticize it all because I don't spend any money. I bring folders from home. You can ask anybody. I'm the worst little person in that office. I think what part of the issue is that we got so far down our bank account on our legal expenses, and that everything that has happened between mudslide and moving, and it's been a whirlwind, a lot of expense and changes. So. Hopefully, moving forward, we'll get ahead. We're in a good spot at the station, and we're the place to have an office ready. Hopefully, what we like for Marines, in the right direction.
I have a couple of questions looking at the check detail. And these are questions of understanding. On page 29, we paid $3,000 to the Coast Union School District. And was that for the rent for this building, for this meeting?
I have $300.
Yes,
$300. Yes, that is. So Christy in the office bills for, I believe she bills every 6 months. So that was for 6 months of regular meetings, and then I think we had a couple of special meetings in that slot. I do have a couple of bills that I'm not paying. I did speak to her, and there is a little confusion about whether or not we would be allowed to have this room for office, but I told her that President Gray had spoken to Kyle Martin, and they're going to, for instance, today we weren't allowed to use these until he came out of the office, and we reminded him that it was there. So it worked out fine. But, yeah, I'm not paying any more bills until I understand completely that we don't have to pay those bills.
And my personal position is that if we don't get this resolved, then we talk with them about the cost of the ambulance and football games, and we make that cost equal to the cost of renting the room.
Back to 1970.
I'm sorry?
Back to 1970. That's when the ambulances started going to games.
Yeah.
And not charging.
So I don't know if we can post charge, but we certainly... I mean, it's we're going to have a meeting between the three presidents of the Community Services District Board, the school district, and our board. And maybe at that level we can get some of these different issues back and forth resolved. I also think that if the health district needs to rent a room at the vets hall for some reason, that should be considered free as well. So we'll work on it.
One or two other questions. I see that we had a couple of payments to Tim Benz Barnes for Unit 19.
So Tim, Unit 19 had to go to Southern California. Again, I am not exactly sure what happened, but I believe that there was something that had to be programmed. It had to go to a place called EVG, and Tim drove it, came and picked it up at 4 o'clock in the morning and drove to Southern California, and it was worked on there.
Drove where? I'm sorry.
He had to drive to Southern California. to a place called EVG. I don't know, I cannot recollect what happened, but it had another issue. And he waited there, and then got home. And I know it was fixed. But that's, those were the, can you tell me the age you're on? First is 29, so that's a reimbursement. He purchased something for unit 19, and I can't remember what it was, but certainly if you want to come in and look at it, I can show you.
39.
And then
31, I should say. The second, the first check.
Yeah, they were both reimbursements for items that he purchased for unit 19.
Okay.
And I have the paperwork at the office, so I don't know if the administrator would like to check it out tomorrow and get back to you. But I apologize, there's been a lot of unit 19 issues, and I don't remember what it was for.
Okay, fair enough. And one last general question. Credit cards. How many credit cards do we have? And I don't mean in the number if we have one from BroboBank.
We only have one credit card, and it's a Cal card, which is a state card that most special agencies have. I have a card, and Jason Melendi has a card, and when you see a U.S. bank, if you sign a U.S. bank check,
mm-hmm.
that is the Cal card charge.
Okay. On page 30, about halfway down, the first entry other than the wire transfers, debits, is the Staples credit plan for computer supplies. Is that a credit card?
No, that's just an online, that's our online account. It's, I suppose you could call it an online credit card. We don't have a credit card, but we have an account with Staples, just like we have an account with Costco. So when we need toner for the Xerox machine, or we need paper, I ordered a desk calendar for Marine, we get it from Staples. It's a lot cheaper, so much cheaper than, it's free shipping, free handling, and you get it the next day.
Okay.
And they have coupons.
Thank you.
No other questions there. We shall move on to the Healthcare Advocacy and Education Committee report.
Okay. My co-chair, Miguel, and I met twice. We met with Jason and Tim Bennis to discuss the EMS staff outreach calendar, and they have a number of activities planned, and also we talked about the existing activities they do. They do a lot of hands-on CPR training during Go Red for Women Month, during Heart Health Month in February. They also do a number of demonstrations to the schools. And we're looking to expand some of what they do by staffing a first aid station at both Pine Dorado and at the 4th of July. And then we also talked about a device called the Life... it's a little information magnet that you put on, people put on their refrigerators at home.
Vial of Life.
Vial of Life. Yeah. So, and it contains all of their medications and anything vital that the paramedic might need to know, and they find that very helpful when they go on calls. So we were exploring ways of covering those costs without going above anything that's been budgeted. We discussed possibly going to Lions or Rotary to get those funds.
Yeah, they're supposed to find the price of those bio, so I haven't heard from him yet, because we would like to see if we can get those through one of the Lions or Rotary, and I think we can accomplish that. I'll be working on that. But I'm supposed to get the price of that because I don't know it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that we talked is to assist in the opioid.
Yes. So Bob Kelly, who's a community member, has developed the Cambria Opioid Project, and will be offering Narcan kits or naloxone, not March kits, I just caught that on the for now, to community members who have need for them. And he made a request that when they are handing these out, that one of our paramedics be present in order to help with the instruction. I talked with Jason, and what I want to do is sit down with Maureen, with the three of us, and Miguel, if you want to as well, to discuss the importance of this project and whether or not we should support it with any personnel. The county has a project called the Opioid Safety, I think it's the Opioid Safety Network, but they are offering or having staff, having pharmacies throughout the county have naloxone kits available, either nasal or injection, and it's being distributed through the pharmacies. And so I have reached out to them. There's a, and they are said that we would qualify to have it run through our pharmacy as well. I know that they have a workshop on February 21st that Miguel is going to attend to learn more about that program. The other things that we did, we went through our goals, which are fairly broad. Excuse me. And so we want to uphold the mission of the healthcare district, but then we also want to go and reassess where we are currently with healthcare services in the community and whether or not there are any new deficits or existing needs. And we would do that by resurveying the community, probably not until this summer at the earliest. It hasn't been budgeted for, so that's something I want to talk with the Finance Committee as well. I think it's raining. Well, it's heater, but it has been raining. And then also to work on partnerships with existing other organizations within the community and throughout the county. And then identifying maybe 1 to 3 projects each year that we would highlight as far as community education from the advocacy committee. So we did have a meeting with some other community members, and so we identified fall prevention as probably something that we really should work on, since it's the number one reason somebody calls for an ambulance or gets transported by our ambulance crew. The county and the CDC both have programs that we can tap into, so we'll be working on that. Abel Martinez wants to be part of this group. He unfortunately couldn't be at the meeting last week, so I want to get his opinion on what we need to do for our Hispanic or Latino population, as well as possibly some of our younger members of the community, as far as what their health needs may be. So I think what I would like the Finance Committee, or we as a group, is to decide how best to for committees to approach the budget and with budget requests, and what type of, if we can come to some kind of standardized way to do it where we identify the problem, we stay where our need is, we cost out what we need, and then we give a reasonable budget for approval by the board.
That's on our list to develop.
Okay.
So the board members will know that.
And then I think it'd be helpful for everybody, because then they'll know what's required in order to ask for additional funding.
I had a question also for Finance Committee, which is that I think when we identify a desire to go to a funding source, whether it's the Cambria Community Foundation or Lions or whomever, it may be useful if we have some sort of a discussion about priorities for going to them.
Yes.
Not critical of your choice of that in any way, but thinking that in a given year we may end up wanting a Stryker gurney, a ambulance, a Files of Life funding, whatever, and we should probably find some way that those requests could be filtered before we go to the agency or organization, so that we don't accidentally get our get one thing when we had a higher priority thing instead.
I agree with that. The way I see it is that discussion that we had with Lori and myself and the other people were that we identify a few programs, but the one that we would like to assist, because we can start doing that right now without really being a specific materials, okay, like a gurney or an ambulance, you name it, it is for I don't cover the time frame that they're going to need the these paramedics, like the 2 hours that they're asking for the opioid treatment. That opioid and that nasal spray is going to be distributed for free. But the only cost for us will be the time that we have to be paid for the two for the individual that's going to be there. So that will be in my committee that I have in, with the Rotary. We have what we call the community help, and so that will be only I could ask him to provide for some monies to assist in the community care that we want to provide through the
So the way I would recommend, just thinking about it, is that a committee that has a identified financial desire would go to the board, okay, working with the administrator first to see how that fit,
yeah,
and then if the board would discuss it, and if they thought it worthy, they could either appropriate those funds as a board, or they could ask the finance committee to evaluate it further.
Okay.
I don't want to put too much bureaucracy into it, but I think the system would make sure that we spend the money in a way that is indeed the board's priority.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
Makes sense.
Sure.
Okay. Sure.
Sorry, did we cut you off? Did you?
Nope, you didn't cut me off, I think. Our next meeting is March 13th at 2 p.m., and we have yet to decide where we will meet.
We hope it's free.
But there's time.
I have a question of understanding about, and you may not know the answer, mm-hmm, the Canberra Opioid Project. They're going to give the drug to individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Are these individuals that are currently, or family members of individuals who are currently taking a prescription for something that could result in an overdose?
Yes, and it's a county, and it's actually a county-wide program. The county is also giving out. The naloxone kits are covered by insurance, so if you have insurance, you can get it at a discounted rate. There are a couple of, there's a program in Paso Robles and one in San Luis, I believe they're needle programs, but they also are giving these out. And so it's for anybody who has a friend or a family member who has concerns that there might be an overdose situation that they could reverse. There's no, my understanding is this drug is, there's no risk with this drug. There's no known bad side effect other than blocking opioid receptors and reversing an overdose. So Mr. Kelly's taken it upon himself to raise money in the community himself to cover the cost and do it this way. So.
Thank you.
Thank you for the excellent report. We are now moving to regular business, item 8A, reviewing the 2019 goals. The idea we had was that if each committee developed goals, then that collectively would provide us with a sense of what we wanted to accomplish in 2019. One question I had in looking at the goals was whether after we review them and think them through, we want to also see if there are some overarching goals that we didn't identify that the board would want that were not represented by any individual committee. I didn't have any particularly in mind, and our new administrator might, as well as Heidi, could suggest. But it may not be a perfect way to create goals to just do it from the committee up. There might be some add-ons that we would want to. But do you have any thoughts, questions, or comments on the three committees who were able so far to produce goals?
Off the top of my head, no. Maybe we could put that on the agenda for next month and think about it.
Look at it again. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Heidi, did you have any questions about the goals or anything you wanted to say?
No. I was looking at the annual audit from the Finance Committee, but I reported that has been the beginning draft, and Director Lawrence gave me his thoughts. So, no, I loved it all.
Excellent. So I got on page 52 of your board packet, we have minutes from the CCSD. And one board member said, why do we have minutes from the CCSD?
I thought that.
are we all going crazy? No, we are not going crazy. Because item 8B is a discussion of moving to simplified version of board minutes for possible action. And I pulled these because I thought they were an example of simplified minutes that may be easier to produce, and I found them pretty easy to scan quickly and read.
Oh.
So, for board discussion.
I am all for the simplified minutes. Anything that we can do, you know, we have a requirement to document what we did and the decisions here. But to spend a lot of time generating minutes for the sake of generating minutes, I don't see much merit in that, particularly in light of every dollar we can spend, say, it doesn't have to be spent by someone, would be it 2 hours or 10 hours or whatever it is, generating minutes each month. We can eliminate that and reduce that something by a number of hours. Why would we not do that?
I was wondering about those 2 pages.
I
read it, and I've been in some of those meetings. They get extensively long and boring. I think it's pretty good. So my motion is to move it to that, to simplify.
And if that's a motion, I'd be more than happy to second.
Heidi, do you have any discussion or comments as the person who writes and oversees the writing of minutes?
No, we used to have very long minutes, and then we made them shorter, and then there were comments that there was not enough meat in the minutes, for lack of a better term. So the CCSD has a very limited discussion. If you're comfortable with that, I think that's perfectly fine. And I have a motion and a second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I would ask Heidi if you do that and you find problems with it, that you would let us know.
Absolutely.
I wanted to give you a quick update on the local hazard mitigation plan annual revision. I sent around some explanation of it, but in brief, the local hazard mitigation plan is a FEMA program that is designed for communities to identify hazards and ways they can work to improve and prevent those problems. And if they produce that in an organized way and submit it to FEMA, they are considered first to get funds if the funds are justifiable. Last year, we worked with the Community Services District, Fire Department, Ambulance, and some other folks, Cambria Fire Safe Focus Group, to create such a document, and it does need annual revision. Looking through it briefly, I saw things that we would want to change ourselves. So what I would like to propose is that I suggest to Bill Hollingsworth, the fire chief, and David Pearson, president of the CCSD, that our Property and Facilities Committee and our administrator meet when they meet in a month or so to go over the plan and identify things that we would want changed. Once we identify those things, that those changes would go back to our board to approve before those changes are made in the document, because it represents all of us. So I just wanted to report on that and make sure that handling it in that way was suitable to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, Do we have any declaration of future agenda items, knowing that if you think of something during the month that you would like added, you may simply email me and I will add it.
I have one thing. We need an approval for the new administrator to be assigned on the checks.
Do we need to vote on that, or can we?
Well, I went to the bank today, and everyone else does not have to come in again. It just needs to show in the minutes that the board approves an additional signer on the all checking accounts and name that person, and that person's they are the administrator. I don't believe we can do it at this meeting.
What I'm wondering is whether under the Brown Act, since we did have the naming of the administrator in this session, if we could not add a motion to do that, since that is tied to the naming of the administrator.
I think it's a bad idea. I think that all that the bank's going to require is that there's something in our minutes showing that you made a motion or added it to her description of her duties.
So I will move relative to the item 4D that we name our new administrator that we approve giving our new administrator signing authority on our account.
Bank accounts, may I ask that you change that to
our
bank accounts, all bank accounts held at Bravo Bank?
Okay. Would it be easier if I was to modify my motion to hire the administrator to say hire and add to all the bank accounts?
Okay, you can do that.
I would like to amend my motion to not only hire Maureen as our administrator, but also to include her as a signer on all our bank accounts at Robo Bank.
A second?
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if during your first month you find that you need some additional powers, let's get them on the agenda so make sure you have everything you need.
For the purposes of your planning, I do have a list of things people have asked me to have on the agenda. One is to invite Don Melendi for Project Heartbeat to come and speak. Iggy would like to be on to report slide and crew quarters assessment. I believe Jason was going to, if I'm going too fast, tell me. Jason was going to provide an inventory list of equipment and what is recommended for sale or disposal. I don't know if the Finance Committee still wants this or not, but there was discussion about potentially changing the payroll account at Pacific Premier to move it to Pacific Premier Bank for two reasons, both access to the room and having our accounts split up between two local banks. Do you still?
Not on the next meeting. I'd like to have a meeting or two with both the administrator and Heidi and work through the mechanics of that potential recommendation.
Okay, so, sorry. CSDA membership value analysis and board goals for discussion. Well, thank you very much. I adjourn the meeting. Maybe I need a motion to adjourn. I don't think you do. Rosenberg's rules say you can just, the chair can adjourn.
Okay, then we're done.
Then we're done.
Okay, I feel tired.
All right.